Well, thank you very much for that very kind introduction. And since I am representing the Council for Agricultural Science and Technology, I would like to just give you just a couple of comments about CAST. CAST is an organization that was started some 40 years ago to really try to explain the importance of science and technology of agriculture, and I think that's something we can all agree with. The primary work of CAST is doing something with information. We can mobilize task forces that includes all scientific disciplines, including non-agricultural disciplines, if it's appropriate to address a particular issue at hand. And, of course, you can see what CAST does online. In fact, if you go to cast.org, you can get reports and all kinds of information that's useful and helpful. And the Friday notes, if you're a member, you get a summary of information every Friday that brings you up to date on what's happening in Washington, as well as a number of different articles and information that's useful and helpful and that sort of thing. We also have an effort in Washington to try to keep our congressional delegation informed from a broad perspective, from 30,000 feet. And now to get to the business at hand today, and first I want to thank you for inviting me. And for those of you that were at the meeting in Chicago, you can either doze a little bit or whatever, but I'm going to say some of the same things, but there will be some different things, so pay attention closely. I really appreciate the opportunity for being with you, and I can tell you, corn, as you already heard from your president, is an important crop. No one would argue with that. In fact, if we had a national crop, I think it should be corn. In fact, we might ought to make corn the national crop because it is such an important crop grown in every single state in the Union, as you well know. And I guess I'm kind of proud of the fact you can call me a part-time corn farmer because I do rotate corn with peanuts. This is the year for peanuts, so I'm not a corn farmer this year, but I will be next year, I promise you. I think the topic of our paper that we were charged to do by the Council for Agricultural Science and Technology, Agricultural Productivity Strategies for the Future, is particularly timely today. I was honored to be a part of a writing team that included two very distinguished entomologists, Luther Tweeden from The Ohio State University and Bob Hurt, from the formerly with the Rockefeller Foundation, but also now at Cornell University. The preface was written by Dr. Norman Borlaug. We had three very able reviewers, Chuck Connor, who was Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, and now with the President and CEO of the National Farmers Cooperatives. Charlie Hess, a formerly administrator in the U.S. Department of Agriculture, more recently University of California, Davis, and Per Pinstrup Anderson from Cornell University. It's a special pleasure to dedicate this particular CAST paper to Dr. Borlaug. I think all of us in this room knew Dr. Borlaug. He was recipient of the 1970 Nobel Peace Prize, but also a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and also the Congressional Gold Medal. And there's not many folks in the world that's received all three of those recognitions. Dr. Borlaug is often called the father of the Green Revolution. He's credited with the British publication The Economist with saving more lives because of his work to alleviate hunger than any other human being. What a legacy that is for an individual. Norm was a founding member of CAST because he believed we should communicate agricultural science and technology to the public at large and to our congressional people and to others. This paper was dedicated to Norm, and he authored CAST paper number one. In fact, this was kind of a follow-up to his first paper in which he talked about the importance of getting the public at large to understand agricultural science and technology. So he was very excited to help us put this paper together, and he wrote the preface to the paper. I want to read a short excerpt from that preface. This is Dr. Borlaug's comment. In the next 50 years, we're going to have to produce more food than we have in the last 10,000 years, and that is a daunting task. I have therefore called for a second green revolution, and I'm going to talk more about that in a few minutes. Well, in this paper, let me tell you some things that we don't do. We certainly describe the challenges that we're facing and present strategies for meeting those challenges. But there's some things we don't do. We don't get into food safety, international trade, farm prices, income support, obesity epidemic, water, rural development, and all of these sorts of things. Rather, we focus the paper on information, knowledge, and technology, and how that will help us meet the challenges that we're going to see in the days ahead. This information is needed by leaders to make sound decisions about agricultural productivity and ensuring its sustainability. To achieve sustainable agricultural productivity in this country, I think we've got to focus on really what builds an economy. There's really two things that builds an economy: manufacturing and agriculture. Manufacturing is building or making something that you need and can use or can sell. Agriculture is something you can grow that's useful to eat or use or sell to somebody else. All of the services in the world will not build an economy. You've got to make something or grow something, and that's what agriculture is involved in, half of those. Given the finite nature of agricultural production resources, such as water, land, plant nutrients, and dealing with the many constraints we have on agriculture, the future success of agriculture is determined largely and can be achieved only by increasing efficiency of productivity. What are the future demands on agriculture? This is something a lot of folks sit around the water coolers and the coffee pot and talk about, but let me tell you what are some of the drivers of this future demand. Clearly, the first is population. Right now, the world's population is somewhere around 7 billion, but it's expected to increase to some 9 billion in not too many years because people are looking for a better standard of living. They increase expectations on the part of everybody. Not only are we going to have 9 billion more mouths to feed, we're going to have more expectations on those other 7 billion that are already here. And, of course, as people increase the standard of living, what's the first thing they want? They want more food, better quality food, and that includes meat, milk, and other animal products. But let me tell you really what's going to drive that. It's going to be the need for energy. And agriculture is very much involved in addressing the inner needs of this planet. So that's another very important thing, I think. They say that 1 billion people today do not get enough food for nourishment. There's another billion that do not get enough minerals and proteins and nutrients and that sort of thing. Poor countries of the world are going to continue needing handouts and support from the more developed countries. But these challenges, along with the existing problems we have of the vagaries of the weather, pests, and so forth, are going to make the challenges we have in agriculture even greater in the years ahead. Based on the median or moderate expectations in population growth, the overall demand for agricultural output is going to be 143% of 2000 output in 25 years, by 2025. It's going to be 179% of 2000 output by the year 2050. That means almost a doubling of agricultural output from what it was in the year 2000 in a short, by 2050, or a short 40 years from now. The thing that's really going to drive agricultural output requirements in the future is energy. In the future, petroleum will continue to become more limited and certainly more expensive, and many more problems such as we're having in the Gulf of Mexico right now, and I think the problem is going to be even more dramatic than it is today. There's no question that we're nearing the end of the era of cheap and readily available petroleum. There's a lot of arguments. In fact, you can't get any two people to agree on when we're going to reach peak oil, if we haven't already. But certainly we've already reached the end of easy-to-get-to energy, because that's why we're drilling in a mile of water in the Gulf of Mexico and other places around the world today. But the recent situation in the Gulf of Mexico, brought to you by BP, is a clear indication of the challenges and the problems that we face in the future. This fact, along with the recognition that agriculture can and will contribute to the energy picture, is certainly something that I think all of us realize is must be taken into account in the future when you talk about agriculture. In fact, I think this ushers in a new paradigm for agriculture, probably will have more impact on agriculture than any other change that's happened in the history of agriculture. Harvesting the sun's energy through green plant photosynthesis is clearly one of the important approaches that will enable us to meet the energy challenge of the future. Clearly, this presents a challenge that sets up potential competitive situations in food versus fuel, as we saw in 2008. And as you know, this became quite a contentious issue, but I think this is something we simply have to live with because agriculture is going to be a part of the energy solution. I promise you that. The opportunity and challenge for agriculture to play an important role is certainly what I call a new paradigm for agriculture for the future. No longer is agriculture just food for humans and feed for livestock and fiber for clothes and homes and flowers for the environment, but you've got to add fuel to that mix in the future. What are the constraints to enable us to meet the agricultural productivity outputs in the future? This is what we have to be concerned about. And I want to run through these very quickly, but there's several, and I think you'll recognize them. Certainly soil erosion is still one. Certainly in some parts of the world, soil erosion is a very serious issue. Water quality and water availability. You can't talk about agricultural productivity without being concerned about water. Water and agriculture go hand in hand. I read a report just a few days ago from the United Nations that were lamenting that, my goodness, we use 70% of the world's water in agriculture. Well, I can't think of a better use for water. I guess you could say it to float houseboats, but anyway, water is going to be a constraint in the future, I promise you. Another one is lack of support or lack of universal support for bioengineered crops. Plants bioengineered to better cope with heat, cold, salinity, too much or too little of water, too much or too little of other parameters, is clearly something that I think is important. And the only way we're going to get there is through genetic engineering, and certainly biotechnology is one of those tools that must have acceptance. But right now, in many parts of the world, that's a constraint. I think future agricultural productivity will depend to a great extent on the powerful tools of biotechnology. There's still significant voices in this country, as well as some parts of Europe, that oppose genetic engineering. And I think that's a concern. Animal welfare issues is also another constraint to agricultural productivity. In fact, animal protein constitutes a major part of the diet of many people on this planet. However, particularly in Europe and certainly in some quarters in this country, there are strong voices that oppose animal agriculture on the surface and underneath. That is a great, great concern that I have and one that I think is going to continue being a constraint on agricultural productivity. In light of that, CAST is sponsoring latter part of this week a major conference on sustaining animal agriculture, balancing bioethical, economic, and social issues. This conference is going to be in Washington Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. CAST has long recognized the challenge of animal agriculture. In fact, we've issued over 20 papers at one time or another in various aspects of animal agriculture. It is a very important area. Another constraint is Endangered Species Act. Preserving the planet's diversity of animals and plants is certainly something that's important, but I can tell you, preserving different species comes at a cost. And I think we have to become more effective in balancing the cost versus benefits of the Endangered Species Act. The one that really concerns me as a constraint is fertilizer. Certainly nitrogen is plentiful. It's 78% of the air is nitrogen, so that should not be a problem. Unfortunately, The only plants that can use that nitrogen are legumes. I'll talk more about this in a minute, but certainly nitrogen is plentiful, but to get it to a use that you can use, certainly in corn, the feedstock is natural gas, which is another finite resource. There's plenty of potassium around the world, but phosphorus is another nutrient that is of great concern to me. The United States extracted 31 million metric tons this past year from a reserve base of 3,400 metric tons remaining in this country. That is about a 100-year supply. Looking at it from a world perspective, the optimistic world supply of phosphorus is about 100 years. The pessimistic supply is probably 40 or 50. So fertilizer or plant nutrients is certainly one of those areas that I'm concerned about. And global climate change is also another area that we need to be concerned about for the future. The crops we grow, where we grow them, how we grow them, all of these things are going to be affected. Whether you believe in global warming or global cooling or whatever, it makes no difference. If there is global change, it will impact agriculture. It will certainly impact where we grow crops, how we grow them, and all that sort of thing. So it is a concern. The uncertainty about the weather will certainly affect agricultural productivity. So that's something we have to be concerned about. As the world becomes more global in nature, there's a greater need to consider agricultural productivity from a global perspective, and I don't think anyone would argue with that. There's really about four countries or regions that I want to mention just briefly. The first of those is China and India, already major, major population centers that will continue to be major population centers in the years ahead. So any discussion of agricultural productivity, China and India are front and center. You know, it was not too many decades ago that the world was concerned about the Chinese population and would there be enough food on the planet to feed them. Well, in the meantime, the Chinese have made a remarkable recovery in developing their agriculture, and they're now net exporters of a number of agricultural products. Another country that you have to think about when you talk about the importance of the future from a world perspective is Brazil. Brazil is probably the country that has the most potential for growth of any location on the planet. So Brazil is important. Then you get to sub-Saharan Africa, a region of the world where a significant portion of the population lives very close to the hunger edge. And they have not been able to increase their productivity to keep in pace with the agricultural needs. The strategies to meet the future needs of agriculture are important and require supportive institutional support, and I can't say this strong enough. Unfortunately and generally, this support has got to come from the public sector because the private sector cannot realize a profit, and that's what drives industry. So this has got to come from the public sector, but this is a very important challenge if we're going to meet the expectations of the future. The question is, how do we help the less developed countries, the countries that really are in desperate need? I'm one that believes that just giving them food is probably counterproductive in the long run. We've got to teach them how to grow food. We've got to teach them something more than just giving them food. While more developed countries spend 2 to 4% of their agricultural gross domestic product on agricultural research, most of the countries of sub-Saharan Africa spend less than 0.5%. That's got to change. They've got to help themselves as long with us helping them. Well, that brings the question to what will enable us to have another green revolution. Well, the first thing I would say is there must be a strong, unwavering commitment to science and technology. It's the responsibility of science to develop information, knowledge, and technology through research that allows leaders to make decisions to reflect the realities of the existing conditions of respective countries in the world. Dr. Borlaug clearly understood this. In fact, if there's anyone that understood this simple point, it was Dr. Borlaug. He understood that agriculture and agricultural policy was clearly a very important step in helping alleviate hunger in some regions of the world. That's why in the last writing he made the statement that we've got to have another green revolution. But the critical question for us today, and if I ask each of you, what are the things that would have to happen to bring about another green revolution? How would you answer that question? I'm going to give you my answer in a few minutes, so you probably can do a better job than I can. But first, I want to emphasize that all branches of science are needed, not just agronomy and not just soil science and not just animal science, but all branches of science and agriculture. But also a lot of other areas as well. The social sciences are very much involved. While in the first Green Revolution, classical genetics that Dr. Borlaug pioneered, some very innovative approaches to classical genetics and wheat breeding, played a key and vital role in bringing about the first Green Revolution. The second Green Revolution is going to be brought about to a great extent by biotechnology. Genetically modified organisms are going to be a key part. That's why it's so distressing to see some circles in some countries in some parts of the world not supporting biotechnology today. But here's some examples that we authors came up with, and you might add to this. But the first one is converting or enabling C3 plants to utilize the C4 photosynthetic pathway. And, of course, as you well know, corn is a C4 plant, which means it is a very, very good shape from that regard. Example number two, nitrogen fixation in non-legumes. Now, that's something that corn does not have. But think what it would be if we could find a way to enable corn to fix nitrogen as does soybean. I think you would all agree that would be a pretty good breakthrough, and that would be a dramatic improvement for agricultural productivity around the world. Number three is incorporating the process of apomixis into crop plants. Apomixis is a system that enables plants to, in essence, clone themselves through seed. Think of the advantages that that would be now. And I readily admit that the corn seed companies might not particularly like that particular trait, but think of the potential power of that particular trait. Number four is improving pest resistance in plants. We need more BT examples and other types of pest resistance that would be helpful, and I think that those will be coming in the years ahead with research. The next example is improving energy efficiency, but also I would add water and nutrient efficiency of plants. You realize that plants now can utilize only about 1-3% of the sun's energy that strikes them. That's a pretty inefficient operation. Even photovoltaic cells are now 15%, and some circles and some research is showing we might get up to 20, even higher percent of photovoltaic cells. But plants are pretty lousy. Only about 1% of the sun's energy is converted into chemical energy which can be used. So that's a real challenge. And there's several others in the paper. If you care to look at the paper that's published in the CAST, we mentioned several other areas that would contribute to a second green revolution. I think you will also agree these are all exceedingly challenging research problems. They're not things that you can drop by the laboratory one day and solve, I can tell you that. There's a lot of people that's already working on each of these. I know that the Gates Foundation is funding a lot of research in the Philippines to develop rice as a C4 plant, because rice is a very, very widely grown plant around the world, and it's a C3 plant. So there's a lot of opportunities there, but very important scientific challenges. Well, what's the commitment to bring about a second green revolution? That's a very important question. And we authors wish we could say that the commitment is there to bring about a second green revolution. My co-authors and I simply don't see it. In fact, I'd be even more dogmatic and say that I don't even see the inkling of a commitment to commit the research to bring about a second green revolution. We need to be making quantum changes in support for ag research if we want to see this happen. There's an abundance of professional scientific literature that clearly shows a strong association between agricultural productivity improvements and commitments in agricultural research. Let me say that one more time. There's a lot of data that clearly shows the relationships between agricultural productivity and agricultural research. It's quite apparent that support for agricultural research has not kept pace with the expectations and needs in this country. Research and development aid to agriculture in the late 1990s was down almost a third from a decade earlier in real spending. Given the unarguable linkage between research and agricultural productivity, any country would be remiss to its people in not supporting what I think is critical for ensuring our survival on this planet in the future. In conclusion, there's a lot of factors that's coming together to create the perfect storm in terms of global food requirements, the energy picture, and all of these. While population growth rates are falling in some countries, the demographers tell us that we're going to continue seeing growth in a number of countries such that the population will reach the 9 billion I mentioned earlier. But that's not the big thing. The big thing is increasing expectations on everybody else. I can tell you, as long as we use 25% of the world's energy on 5% of the people, don't think the rest of the world don't want to live just that good. And they're not going to stop till they get there. I can tell you that. So that should be a wake-up call for anybody that has anything to do with supporting agricultural research. In addition to increasing demands for food for those reasons I just gave, the energy picture puts a completely different perspective on everything, because I can tell you that we are going to reach peak oil if we haven't already. And oil will continue to be more expensive, more difficult to get to. Someone was just talking earlier about we now have technology maybe to go to 40,000 feet, and that's frightening. That's almost 8 miles down. So, and we obviously don't have the research, they don't have the research to figure out what to do when you have a cataclysmic event. If you want to see what happens when you don't have research, just turn on the TV and listen to what happened to the Gulf of Mexico. You know, I had an associate director of the experiment station when I was dean and director of the experiment station at Auburn University that used to say, once you need the results of research, it's too late to start. Someone should have told BP that a few years ago. They were doing research on how to stop the oil leak while it was gushing forth. Not a good way to do research. So we need to be thinking about that for agriculture. And my point is a wake-up call to let's start doing the research that we know we're going to need, because oil and natural gas and coal are finite resources. That means they're going to run out one day. Now, whether it's in the decade or the next century or in three centuries, they're going to run out at some point, and we need to be doing the research that ensures a sustainable future. Responding to the needs is not solely the province of the government, certainly not Congress, industry leaders, or state governments. The public at large has got to be involved. And this is the point Dr. Borlaug always made, is that everybody's got to be involved in this. Everybody has got to have a stake, and they've got to be concerned, particularly on such broad issues as global climate change. How do we respond to that? Environmental regulations, animal welfare, natural resource utilizations, investments in agricultural research and education. These are all factors that the public at large has a stake in. The greatest concern of the authors of this paper was the apparent lack of commitment of research by the United States and many other countries to do the necessary research and education to address the challenges that I've outlined here this evening. They are important for the future. Failure to anticipate research needs is unforgivable. the case of BP as an example. Something might have happened, but they should have done research a long time ago before they had the problem. Remember, if you wait until you need the results, you've done waited too long. It will take a strong and constant public commitment to address environmental regulations, global climate change, acceptance of new technology, and support for adequate research funding if we're going to survive on this planet. We are hopeful and confident that we can and will make such a commitment. Indeed, we really don't have any choice. Thank you very much.